Welcome to the Couch Potatoes. I'm Brett McGarry. At long last, a campaign that feels almost as long as the presidential election comes to an end this week on Hollywood's Biggest Night.
I'm Jeff Braun. Yes, it's Oscar weekend and the end, finally, of award season.
And we've got a couple of big new movies this week. I'll tell you about the latest big-name sports documentary on Netflix and tell you if it makes the cut.
But first, the Oscars, and the question is, can anything Stoppenheimer Oppenheimer?
They won't fear it. Until they understand it. And they won't understand it. Until they've used it. I don't know if we can be trusted. With such a weapon. But we have no choice.
The answer, of course, is no, nothing can stop Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer, it's a Lockenheimer. I'll stop doing that now, I'm sorry. Couldn't help myself.
I love it.
The Oscars are this Sunday, starting an hour earlier than usual, 7 Eastern, 6 Central, 5 Mountain, 4 Pacific. It'll be hosted by Jimmy Kimmel again. He's the go-to guy the last decade or so. He's always doing a good job when he hosts the Oscars. He has a way of kind of being edgy if he wants to be, but without coming off as a jerk. There's a really good crop of movies this year. Overall, I'd say it's the best since 2019 when we had things like Parasite, 1917, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and so on. This year, the 10 movies vying for Best Picture are Oppenheimer, of course, Barbie, Anatomy of a Fall, Killers of the Flower Moon, Past Lives, The Zone of Interest, Poor Things, Maestro, American Fiction, and The Holdovers. For my money, I'd say 8 of those 10 are terrific. Poor Things just wasn't for me, although a lot of people really like it, and it could win a handful of awards. And Maestro, that just didn't connect. There are a lot of good things in it, but it just didn't add up to anything for me. The rest, though, I thought were dynamite, and hopefully, while Oppenheimer will likely and deservedly win a bunch of Oscars, I hope they kind of spread it around a bit. We'll see. The acting awards seem mostly set, especially in the supporting categories, with Robert Downey Jr. expected to win for Oppenheimer, and the real lock of the night is The Holdovers' Divine Joy Randolph, who has apparently won every award for which he was eligible over the last few months. Cillian Murphy expected to win Best Actor for Oppenheimer, which would be fitting. I think the biggest question mark acting-wise is Best Actress. It'll be between Lily Gladstone for Killers of the Flower Moon, and she's probably the favorite, but Emma Stone in Poor Things could play spoiler. One award I'm really hoping to see, Brett, is Best Original Score go to John Williams. It's his 54th nomination. He only trails Walt Disney for the record, who had 59. But John Williams hasn't won in 30 years. He hasn't won since Schindler's List. And to see him win for Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny would be a real nice treat and a fitting send-off from the industry because he is now retired. The Dial of Destiny was the last movie for which he will make the music. And I noticed Steven Spielberg's a presenter, and you sort of assume he'll hand out Best Director or Best Picture, but I thought, hey, maybe he'll do Best Score and get to hand John Williams an Oscar. Spielberg has often said Williams has been his greatest collaborator over the years, and it would make sense. When you even just hear the words Jaws, Indiana Jones, or Jurassic Park, the music pops into your head real fast. So that's a moment I'm hoping for. The other one I'm sort of hoping for is to hand out Best Picture, how about Jeremy Renner? I don't think that guy's made a public appearance since his accident last year.
Oh.
He did have the interview with Diane Sawyer on ABC, and he's released a couple of home videos of him as his rehabilitation from that snowplow accident. So if that guy marches out to hand out Best Picture, that's a standing O right there, I would think.
Yeah. That would be just gold.
Yeah, so that's cool. But I guess what I'm hoping we don't get is some embarrassing scene like the slap or the envelope mess up that happened with La La Land and Moonlight, although that at least was weird and different, and actually a better movie came out on top, so I like that moment. But we'll find out. We'll find out what happens Sunday night at the Oscars.
And thank you for pointing out that it starts earlier this year. I had not heard that it's beginning at 6 p.m. this weekend. That's usually one of those things where I'll check, like, the day of to set my PVR.
Yeah.
And then I would have seen, 6 p.m. But yeah, it looks like they are doing that because there's typically a steep drop-off in viewers as the third hour approaches.
Because it goes long and late and people got to go to bed.
Yeah. And in the East Coast, that's just super late. So this way it'll stay in primetime hours. And the goal is always 3 to 3.5 hours, and that rarely happens. You talk about some of the things you're hoping for and hoping to not see. For me, what I'm hoping for simply is fun.
Yeah.
And let's go back to 2008 at the Oscars, the 79th Academy Awards. Will Ferrell takes to the stage to sing.
A comedian at the Oscars, the saddest man of all. Your movies may make millions, but your name they'll never call.
He's then joined by Jack Black and things go insane.
We may not win tonight, but we shall win the ultimate fight. And I'm not speaking in a metaphor. I mean, literally, I am going to fight the nominees.
I like the way you're talking. I'm sick of this crap.
Leo, you think you can date supermodels and win awards? I'm going to elbow you in the larynx.
Ryan Gosling, you're all hip and now. Well, I'm going to break your hip right now.
One of my all-time favorite moments from the Oscars, and then a surprise from the crowd.
Fellas,
John C. Reilly.
This madness must stop. There is no need to fear. You can have your cake and eat it too. Just look at my career. I didn't cry the blues. I didn't pick silly fights. I chose to be in both Boogie and Talladega Nights.
I'm trying to figure out. He says I could be in both
Boogie and Talladega Nights because he's
Thank you.
Boogie Nights and Talladega Nights.
Okay, because I was looking at his filmography and I saw Boogie Nights and I thought, is that what he's saying there? But I just, thank you. I'm so glad I brought that up because that was driving me insane that I could not figure that out. Perfect. Yeah. Absolutely perfect. So yeah, I just want like some genuine fun.
Agreed.
And if you want to just find that, just look up Will Ferrell sings at the Oscars, Jack Black and John C. Reilly, and you will find it. It's hysterical. Now, one of the big movies, and I think did the first one get nominated for Best Picture, or it got a bunch of technical nominations?
I think
it was just
a bunch of technical nominations, but this second part, people are saying it could get some Best Picture nominations as the season goes on next year. I went back to the desert this week to see Dune Part 2.
My allegiance is to you. Do you believe me?
Your father was a weak man. He believed in the rules of the heart. But the heart is not meant to rule.
I am Paul Atreides, Duke of Arrakis!
And I will do what must be done.
Dune, rated PG-13, only in theaters, March 1st.
This is real easy as far as recommendations go. If you like Dune Part 1, you're going to like Dune Part 2. And if you didn't, you probably won't. So I did, and I did. The movie is The Continuing Adventures of Paul Atreides, played by Timothy Chalamet, as he tries to survive and then thrive on the desert planet of Arrakis. Some spoilers for Part 1. Can't really talk about Part 2 without talking about Part 1, because when we last left Paul and his mother, played by Rebecca Ferguson, they were fleeing the capital for the desert to join the desert-dwelling Fremen society led by Javier Bardem, featuring Zendaya. This movie finds Paul learning their ways and coming to grips with the notion that he may be somehow be their messiah. And religion plays a huge part in these movies in a more interesting way than you might expect. Paul has a lot of gifts, but he's maybe also playing into this chosen one stuff more than he actually believes in it. The bad guys are back. The Harkonnens, led by Stellan Skarsgård, featuring Bautista and Austin Butler, who all had a hand in destroying Paul's family with the help of the Emperor's family, which is played by Christopher Walken, featuring Florence Pugh. So it's this time of generational change in politics and religion in this universe, and nothing's ever going to be the same. I feel like they really tear through a lot more story in this one than the last, although the pacing of the scenes in the movie feels the same. So sadly, Brett, if you were bored by that first movie, you'll probably feel a little bit bored by this one as well. I'm glad that I very recently rewatched Dune Part 1 with the subtitles on, because there's a lot of world building with specific names and titles festivals for people, places, and things, and it can just be tricky. I mean, Chalamet himself is called by at least four different names in part two, which I found a little frustrating. It looks amazing, this movie. It sounds amazing. If you are going to see this, you should go to the theater, and you should look for the biggest screen you can find at the theater. The movie was actually so loud at times that it kept setting off the decibel alert thing on my Apple Watch, and when it went to the bathroom, which I had to do multiple times because it's 2 hours and 45 minutes
you
long.
You called it. You said you were going to have to go to the bathroom.
Oh. But the bathroom's down the hall, across the way, and around the corner, and I could still hear the movie booming while I was in there.
Oh, wow.
You know how sometimes you're sitting in a theater and you can hear sound from the theater next door?
Yeah.
I would not want to be watching a movie in the theater next to Dune 2. I feel like a lot of people probably experienced that this weekend as well when they weren't at Dune. The special effects are top shelf. It actually looks really real most of the time. Not like cartoony real or real, but with some bad CGI. It just looks great. And they don't try to push their luck. I mean, the spaceships aren't doing barrel rolls and things like that. Everything sort of looks like it could really be, even though it's incredible. And the spectacle is the reason to watch this. The story is fine. It's not really anything we haven't seen a variation of many times before. But as we discussed last week, the book it's based on is really old. And a lot of other things that came to the screen before Dune were ripping things off from Dune the book. So it's kind of hard to fault Dune for that. Javier Bardem is probably the highlight character-wise. He brings a lot of the comic relief in a movie that takes itself very seriously. Austin Butler is appropriately menacing for being the new bad guy, and Zendaya gets to shine a lot more than she did in the first one. She's barely in it. She didn't get much to do there. She's got it, and she just pops off the screen like a movie star should. Between her, Florence Pugh, Chalamet, and Butler, that's a pretty good cast of young actors who could kind of lead their generation on the big screen for the next 15 or 20 years. The confusion over the sequels, there needs to be a part three to this. I won't get into it, obviously, but the ending kind of solves one issue and opens another can of sandworms, and I would feel cheated if they don't continue this story. It's kind of sequel bait at the end, despite whatever Denis Villeneuve or others might be saying in interviews. They're off to a great start. They made $200 million worldwide in their first week. I'm sure they'll rake in a lot more this weekend as well. Great stuff, real treat. 4 couch cushions out of 5 for Dune Part 2.
All right, and up next, we'll tell you what's new at the movies this weekend. You are listening to The Couch Potatoes. I'm Brad. He's Jeff. We are The Couch Potatoes. Got to tell you what's new in the theaters this weekend. We got a couple in theaters and then one on Netflix, and we are going to start with a forequel.
It is time to take the next step on your journey.
I'm not going to be the dragon warrior anymore.
You will advance to spiritual leader of the Valley of Peace.
Inner peace. Inner peace.
Keep your surf off my turf!
Dinner, please. Dinner with peas in a sesame soy glaze.
This is not working at all.
Kung Fu Panda 4. The first one came out in 2008, the sequel in 2011, the threequel in 2016, and that was seemingly the end of the trilogy. There were other cartoons and stuff, but for movies, it felt like that was it. Wrong! We must go back to the well. The Kung Fu Panda is Po, voiced by Jack Black. He is the Dragon Warrior. He's a buffoon, but when it's time to fight, he'll get ya. But there's always some big bad who wants to take him down.
Tai Lung, big fan.
Once I possess the Kung Fu of every master villain, no one will dare question my power.
Not even the great Dragon Warrior.
Who's that?
The most powerful shape-shifting sorceress, the Chameleon.
How do I find this, the Chameleon?
So the Chameleon is voiced by Viola Davis. Poe's companion is voiced by Awkwafina. The supporting cast also includes Dustin Hoffman, returning as Poe's adopted father, Shifu. James Hong, returning as Mr. Ping. Bryan Cranston is Poe's biological dad, Lee. Ian McShane returns to voice the deadly Tai Lung. And Ki-Hee Kwan joins the cast as Han. I love the first three movies. They're just so much fun. The animation is wild. And they were all big hits that both kids and adults can enjoy. This new one is getting decent reviews, not as good as the original three, and some of the reviews I've read and seen suggest it's more childish than the first three. Nothing wrong with making movies specifically for kids, but if it's just for kids, I don't know. But I will see it eventually because I love the Kung Fu Panda. If you want to watch the first three, by the way, of course, they're not centrally located on streaming. The first one is on Netflix and Paramount Plus. Second one's on Paramount Plus. The third one is on Prime Video. And the fourth one is on the big screen this weekend. Also new on the big screen this weekend is something called Imaginary. And this has to do with a woman who returns to her childhood home to discover that the imaginary friend she left behind is very real and very unhappy that she left.
Kids all have imaginary friends.
So cute.
I like your new friend, Alice.
He says you're not allowed to play with us because you left him.
Alice?
Why would you do that? He's not imaginary.
What the hell is this?
Imaginary. Rated PG-13. Only in theaters March 8th.
So it's about a killer teddy bear. It's from Blumhouse. As they describe themselves, the genre-defining masterminds behind Five Nights at Freddy's and Mithrigan comes an original horror that taps into the innocence of imaginary friends and begs the question, are they really figments of childhood imagination or is something more terrifying lying just beneath, I don't know, neat concept, I guess, kill a teddy bear. We were all probably scared something might come alive and kill us when we were kids. And then on Netflix, Millie Bobby Brown stars in Damsel.
It is this sacrifice we commemorate every generation. A tradition going back centuries. A legacy of honor and duty you now inherit.
This actually looks pretty cool. It's about a dutiful damsel who agrees to marry a handsome prince, only to find the royal family has recruited her as a sacrifice to repay an ancient debt. She's thrown into a cave with a fire-breathing dragon, and she must rely on her wits and will to survive. Great cast in this. Ray Winstone, Ashore Agdashloo, Angela Bassett, Robin Wright, just to name a few. Looks cool. That is out this weekend on Netflix. Up next, we got to tell you about Shogun. You are listening to The Couch Potatoes.
Welcome back to The Couch Potatoes. I'm Jeff, he's Brett, and I started watching the new Shogun series on Disney Plus.
I've learned one truth. The enemies are everywhere and friends nowhere.
Tuesday.
My lord is famous for his trickery.
What happens if he's found?
He will be killed, and all of us.
God be with you. You'll lead him.
FX's Shogun. All new Tuesdays.
I've never read the book or watched the previous miniseries from 1980. Shogun is an FX series available on Disney Plus as well here in Canada and Hulu in the States. It's set in 1600 in Japan, which at the time was not an easy place to get to if you weren't already there. The Portuguese have found it and they control all trading with the outside world as they're the only ones who know how to get to Japan from the outside world. But the show opens with a ship of Englishmen who are lost at sea. That's what they claim. And land there by accident. Their de facto leader, John Blackthorne, is taking up the various chains of command to meet the regent of the area, Lord Yoshi Torinaga, played by Hiroyuki Sanada. He's a Hall of Fame that guy. You have definitely seen him in things, probably a lot of things. He was in John Wick 4 last summer, for example. I always think of him as Dogen from Lost, the guy who was in charge of the temple. Now he's one of the leads in this, so good for him. He's one of five regents who rule Japan after the top boss, the Shogun, passed away with an heir who is only a young boy. These five regents, I gather, are meant to rule together until the young heir is 16 years old and can take control. And these five regents are about to go to war by the looks of things. There's already bad blood between Torinaga and the others. There's also a very significant religious component. The Portuguese have brought Christianity to Japan, and a couple of the regents have bought in hard while others have not, and there will be conflict there. And it doesn't help that this boat full of Englishmen are all Protestants and not Catholics, so there's some conflict there. There are a ton of moving pieces going on. It is an awful lot of stuff all at once, and frankly, after having to dive back into all the Dune mythology and world building, doing it the same week for Shogun was kind of exhausting. But the good news is Shogun is very good. It's entertaining in a fun way, and the trouble with a lot of these kind of shows is that they're so concerned with all their history or mythology or whatever that they take themselves incredibly seriously and forget to have fun and just, you know, come off like a history lesson, which is dumb because they also tend to not tell straight history anyways. This is a fictionalized version of real history, and there is humor and light touches to contrast some of the very serious action. There's a breeziness to a lot of it that was very welcome. So it's not homework to watch Shogun, even though some of the commercials or whatever might kind of make you wonder about that. At least not in the early going. Hopefully they keep it up. They're off to a great start. There is some brutal violence. There is swords chopping off heads and worse, and some nudity as well. This is a rated R affair. It's also in a mixture of English and Japanese, and it took me a minute to figure this out, that when they're speaking English, it's actually them speaking Portuguese. So it's this weird move where they have Japanese spoken as Japanese, but Portuguese as English, because it's an American production from FX. So I, you know, take it up with them. You got a problem with that. But I watch with subtitles on for everything anyways these days, so it didn't really bother me that much. But yeah, I'm all in on the Shogun. It's on every Tuesday night. They've got three so far, and I can't remember how many it is total. It'll be 8 or 10 or 12 at the most, I'm sure. It's good stuff. I would highly recommend it. I think so far it's the best show of this year.
Thank you for the reminder. I meant to get to that this week, and I also meant to preview The Gentleman, which is now out on Netflix. That's that new Guy Ritchie series. Same world as his movie, but I didn't quite get to that. So hopefully I'll take a peek at both.
Yeah.
This over the course of the next week.
Yeah, and besides Showgirls, oh my God, I knew it was going to happen sooner or later, Brett.
Mixing a great new television show with one of the worst movies made in history.
But besides Shogun and Dune Part 2, I also went to the theaters and saw a tearjerker, a crowd pleaser this week. Reacher made me cry in a movie called Ordinary Angels.
I read about your family and I wanted to help.
I'm not comfortable with this.
You're going to have to get comfortable being uncomfortable. Because this is about your little girl. She's 5 and needs a liver transplant.
On February 23rd.
They're asking us to reduce the family's medical bills.
I'm asking you to erase them. Was that funny?
Make a choice to make a difference.
We all need to find meaning outside ourselves.
I appreciate everything you've done.
I'm good at plenty of things. Taking no for an answer ain't one of them.
Ordinary Angels. Rated PG. Only in theaters February 23rd.
Ordinary Angels stars 2-time Oscar winner Hilary Swank and human giant Alan Ritchson, a.k.a. Reacher. It's at 85% on Rotten Tomatoes. It made close to $15 million so far, earning back its budget at least. And it's also getting good word of mouth. And here's some more. Reacher plays Ed, a Kentucky man with a wife and 2 young daughters. But in the opening scene, basically, the wife dies. They are sad, and then they get super sad when the youngest daughter, little 5-year-old Michelle, has liver trouble and almost dies a lot. She's in desperate need of a transplant. Time is running out. Money ran out a long time ago. The bills are staggering. Reacher is hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt from his wife's illness and now his daughter. Meanwhile, also in their little Kentucky town, we have Swank's character, Sharon. She's an alcoholic hairdresser estranged from her 23-year-old son because of the drinking. It's got her bad until one day her colleague and friend gets her to try to give it up. She ends up hearing about Michelle's problem and decides that helping them will help her too, and she makes it her mission. Never mind the fact that she's never met these people before. And even though, you know, Ed tries to get rid of her because she's just some weirdo stranger to him who's trying to help too much, she won't go away and indeed starts to find ways to raise money, consolidate debt, get free favors to help the family out, things like that. And she also keeps trying to connect with her son who wants nothing to do with the drunk woman who sucked at raising him. And also, sadly, she kind of keeps on drinking. As you can imagine, when the drinking suddenly shows up in Ed's world with his young daughters, he's not particularly happy with that. So there's a lot going on. None of it's kind of particularly new. It's some familiar beats. Aside from the drinking, she sort of comes across as kind of like a Aaron Brockovich kind of type. The performances, though, really make this movie worthwhile. I mean, it's no surprise that Hilary Swank is pulling this off. She's one of the best actors of her generation. Richson, on the other hand, surprised me. He's a good actor with more range than the Reacher show might have you believe. And for being as big as he is, he somehow does not seem that big in this. He's still, you know, kind of a huge guy, but his troubles have really beat him down. And despite his giant frame, he's playing a small kind of shell of a man. It's really quite a impressive physical transformation, sort of like Christopher Reeve when he was from Superman to Clark Kent, that kind of thing. The kid actors are also great. There's no cringe there. And Nancy Travis plays Ed's mom. And if I'm being honest, Nancy Travis has never been one of my favorites, but she is kind of great in this. So I enjoyed seeing everybody who popped up on screen. The final act kind of revolves around a snowstorm and a race to a hospital in the snowstorm. Should also say it's based on a true story, and should also say they shot this movie in and around Winnipeg, where we are, Brett, and the building we are currently sitting in is the setting for one scene, at least the outside of it is. I don't know if they came inside or not. Maybe they just used the outside, but it was neat to be sitting in a theater and point to the screen and say, hey, I work in that building. That's kind of fun. There are a lot of bad schmaltzy versions of this kind of movie that, you know, go straight to video or whatever, Hallmark movies. And there are also Oscar bait versions of this that would dive further into some of the sadder aspects of the story. But Ordinary Angels kind of finds a really nice middle that is engaging and entertaining and gives you something, you know, a few things good to cry about, a few things bad to cry about. It's good stuff all around. I thought 3.5 couch cushions, surprisingly, out of 5 for Ordinary Angels.
Right on. Up next, we're going to tell you about season 2 of a sports documentary on Netflix. The first season was all right. The second season looked more promising. Did it fulfill its promise? You are listening to The Couch Potatoes. I'm Brett. He's Jeff. We are The Couch Potatoes. Right now, I am excited to tell you about a show that just started on Netflix. It debuted on Wednesday, March 6th, season 2 of Full Swing.
It's been quite the year in the world of professional golf.
Some serious breaking news. The PGA Tour today announced a controversial deal with the headline-grabbing LIV Golf.
Oh.
What happened?
There has been a lot of controversy and a lot of uncertainty.
To see the players from the LIV Golf Tour go up against the PGA Tour.
Sort of changed the dynamic between you guys.
A lot of people feel a bit of betrayal.
I feel like a sacrificial lamb.
You feel like you should be compensated for not going to live?
Yeah, pass.
So Netflix has developed kind of a bit of a good history here with its sports documentaries. Formula One Drive to Survive, which is now in its 6th season, remains one of the platform's bigger hits. It's actually been in the top 10, near the top for the last couple of weeks because it just came out a few weeks ago. And in fact, it's actually altered ratings for F1 in a good way. More people are watching F1 because they watch Drive to Survive. They've got a tennis documentary. Of course, The Last Dance aired on Netflix. Now, to be fair, that was an ESPN production, but it did air in Canada on Netflix. So now we have season 2 of Full Swing, about a year after the first season debuted. And I am a golf fan, but the great thing about these documentaries, not just Netflix, any good documentary, not just sports documentary, you don't need to know the subject matter. It might help, or actually in this case, I think it might hinder your enjoyment if you are a super fan, and I'll get to that in a minute. But season 1 of Full Swing, it was pretty cool. You got lots of behind-the-scenes stuff and a really close look at some of the biggest names in golf. And it was pretty cool to see them so candid and to see them swearing and goofing around and stuff. And you see more of that in season 2. But season 1 was a disappointment. Like, I like golf. I like those guys. But I don't know. It just felt like it was missing something. And I think what it felt like it was missing was really delving into the drama between, that you heard in that clip, the LIV Golf Tour. So this is this rival tour that's sprung up that is led by the Saudis, and they've been stealing players from the PGA, and they're offering them hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. The money is absolutely insane. So there was a lot of drama there, and I think that kind of fell into the lap of the documentarians while they were doing their first season and already had their plan. So in season 2, I was thrilled that they just dove face first into that controversy. And Rory McIlroy was the central figure of that first episode. He is a big time golfer, one of the most popular golfers, maybe the most popular golfer on planet Earth, who actually plays regularly. Tiger Woods is still the most popular, but Rory was essentially the guy who was the figurehead for the PGA. So he felt betrayed by certain things. I don't really want to spoil what happens in this. You know, you can watch the trailer and figure out a couple of things, but I think that's important to helping with your enjoyment of this. And I say that as a golf fan because the first two episodes I thought were terrific. I really enjoyed the third episode, which was about a couple of guys named Wyndham Clark and Joel Damon. Joel Damon was actually featured in the first season of Full Swing. And in this season, we see how he's having to deal with fame combined with parenthood. He's a new dad, but because of the first season of Full Swing, he's way more famous now. So he's having a hard time dealing with that. And as a result, his game has sucked. So the whole episode is about the mental game and how do you deal with that? And I can relate to it so much because I am a total basket case pretty much all the time, especially on the golf course. So I really liked that. The fourth and fifth episodes were okay, but then the final three episodes focused entirely on the Ryder Cup. And that's a huge event that happens every 2 years. It's a team of 12 Americans take on a team of 12 Europeans. And as I was going through the sixth episode, so the intro to the Ryder Cup stuff, I realized I couldn't remember a thing that happened from the Ryder Cup. And it didn't happen that long ago. It was only a few months back, but I couldn't remember who was on the team because there was some drama, who's going to make the team, who's not going to make the team. And then I just couldn't remember. I couldn't remember who won or how they won. So for me, I found it gripping. But here's something to know. If you just Google Full Swing Season 2 reviews, any golf publication or golf blog seems to be slamming it. Like, they don't like it. They say it's good, not great, or it misses the mark once again. But then you'll find other reviews that just come from, like I read one in the Daily Mail, that sung its praises. So I overall, I thought this was way better than the first season. I enjoyed the first season, but it was just kind of meh overall. This one I thought was really cool. I loved the first two episodes. The third episode really spoke to me and I think might actually end up helping not just golfers, but a lot of people. And then the final three episodes were a lot of fun. So it might actually help you, the less you know about golf, the better to enjoy this show, because it sounds like the hardcore golfers are dumping on this show. So I don't really get that. So Full Swing Season 2 debuted on Wednesday, March 6th, 8 episodes. And I just want to quickly touch on this and sort of wrap this up because it's been a journey for me the last 3 weeks. So I got to wrap up because I wrapped up the full series of Avatar: The Last Airbender.
100 years passed and my brother and I discovered the new Avatar, an airbender named Aang. And although his airbending skills are great, he has a lot to learn before he's ready to save anyone. But I believe Aang can save the world.
So this journey started about 3 weeks ago when I started watching the first season of Avatar: The Last Airbender, the live-action Netflix adaptation that is based on a beloved cartoon from 2005 to 2008 on Nickelodeon. And it's a fantasy world where some people can like manipulate water, and some people can manipulate the air, and some can manipulate fire, and some can manipulate the earth. And only the Avatar can control all four elements, and they need Aang, the Avatar, to defeat the Fire Lord because he's declared war on the whole world. So I quite enjoyed the live action. I started watching the cartoon and I really enjoyed the first season, and I have since finished all three seasons and I thought it was great. And the climax, I was wondering, like, how cool is this climax going to be in a cartoon? It was insane. When Aang the Avatar does finally meet the Fire Lord, that's not a spoiler. That's what the whole show is about. That's his destiny. It was bonkers. And I think it would be incredibly difficult and expensive to bring to live action. They probably have to cut it short, which I think would anger fans. And then I actually, after finishing the series, I've now rewatched the first live action episode. And in many ways, it felt like I was watching it for the first time because I was now watching it through the lens of, okay, I've seen the cartoon. What's different here? So it's been a wild ride. Avatar: The Last Airbender, live action and cartoon, both available on Netflix. I'm Brett. He's Jeff. We are the Couch Potatoes. Remember, if it requires getting up off the couch, don't bother.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.